Okay, so let's get started. The homework is finally out. I couldn't put it up yesterday. I sent mail saying I couldn't contact the TA because of all these weather delays and whatnot. So finally I got the homework from him in the night and I have put it up. Okay, it's due a week from today. So you still get the same amount of time. So you don't have to worry about that part of it. Alright, so let us start. Now, quick question before I start. I haven't yet put up the podcast page, although the podcast feed is working. I haven't put up the URL to see how to download it. Is that useful or are you just happy with downloading individual audio files? Does anyone care one way or another? I will put it up, but I just wanted to know if somebody is interested in trying that option out. We are still getting the video thing worked out. There was some problem last time, so they couldn't. The capture didn't produce any good output, so we are trying to fix those problems. But the audio part is working fine. Okay. So, in any case, I will put up the necessary information for all of you to access. So, coming back to the lecture. What we were talking about last time was process and code migration. And in the context of process migration, we said the big problem there is not migrating the state of the process. That's easy. You're just copying memory pages from one machine to another. But what happens when the process that is being migrated is accessing some resources, open files, network socket, hardware devices, CD-ROM, printers, and so on. So what do you do in that case when the process moves to another machine? Those resources may not move. So how do you handle this scenario? Okay. So to understand whether the resource, so one thing you could do is of course migrate the resource, but this may or may not work depending on the type of the resource. So if you have specific identifiers like a URL or a FTP site, this is not going to move with you. That's pretty heavy duty. It is tied to a particular machine. So if your program was accessing or downloading something from that site or workflow local, that you can assume will not move. So in this case, the resource is accessed by identifier. The identifier is tied to a particular machine and or hardware. So the resource doesn't move, okay, when the process moves. And you need to handle this scenario. Okay. Now, the resource could be linked to the process by value. An example of a value resource is a Java library, okay, Java whatever 1.5 or C library of a certain version. Okay. In this case, the machine that the process is moving to may have the same resource. It may also have a copy of Java already installed or the C library. In this case, you don't have to move the resource. You can just rebind to the local resource. And the last one is by type. So here we are making the type of the resource even more vague. You just want a printer. It doesn't matter whether you're printing on a HP laser printer or let's say a Canon printer. You just want to print this document. Okay. So if you want to move to another machine, if there's a local printer there, you could just print. It doesn't matter whether the previous machine had a printer of a certain type and here it's something else. Okay? You just want any resource of that class, and here the class is a printer or a local device. Okay? Here you not only specify the class, but you also want specific version. So it's not just any Java library or any C library. Your program may require a certain version, so that is more specific. So as you go up here, it gets more and more specific. And here you want that resource. Nothing else will do. Here anything within this category will do. And here it's just a printer. You're not even specifying exactly what type you care about. Okay. So this will inform us on what we need to do when we migrate the application. How do we continue to provide it access to resources it was already accessing? Okay. There could also be a notion of how attached the resources to that machine. Okay, suppose that you want to consider moving the resource with the process. Okay. Some resources can move and others cannot. So if the process is accessing a local file and the file is small, you could certainly move the file with the process. Okay, it's inexpensive, it can be done. Okay, and then you continue to access the file on the new machine. Now, if the file was, let's say, a large file, let's say it was a database, okay, a 2 gig database, just to give an example. Okay, of course, this resource can be moved, but at a high cost. Okay, and you want to do it only if you get the benefit of this migration. Ideally, you would not want to do it, but it can be moved, but you want to only pay the cost when the benefits are apparent. Okay. And the third type of resource is something that cannot move. Okay, here example is hardware device. Okay, there's a printer attached to the machine. The process moved, the printer certainly cannot be migrated, at least not automatically. Right. Communication endpoints are another issue. So if the process is has open network sockets. Okay. Sockets are tied to IP addresses, and the IP addresses are local to not local but unique to a machine. So if the process moves, certainly the IP address is not going to move. The IP address of the new machine is going to be different. You cannot just if you have established socket connection, you cannot move them. Okay. So if some other machine has established a TCP connection to this machine and is communicating with this process, the process moves elsewhere. TCP connection is not going to move. This other process is still going to communicate to the socket that's already established. So this is a big problem. So how do you handle this? Okay, so these are issues that we will consider. So here's a table that shows what are the possible things one could do in order to maintain access to the resource even after the migration. Okay. So there are four possibilities. Okay. One is what is called establish a global system-wide reference. What this means is there is a unique name for this resource across any machine in your network. So you can continue to provide remote access to this resource by using that name. URL is an example. If you had a browser, it was accessing CNN, and if you move the browser for whatever reason to another machine, it can still go to this resource by using the same name. Okay, because the name uniquely identifies the resource, and the resource is accessible from any machine on the network. So if you have that kind of resource, then you basically just continue to use this reference, system-wide reference, and access the resource as if nothing has happened. Okay. Move is a possibility. We already talked about it. So if you do move, then you're migrating the resource with the process. You could also do a copy. Okay. Copy is basically you just made a separate copy, and then you continue to access that resource locally. So in this case, the resource hasn't moved, but you just made an extra copy that the process can continue to access. And rebind just says that you'll just rebind this process to a locally available resource of the same type, of same category. Okay. So if you had this notion of libraries, for example, your process is moving with the C or Java library, it doesn't have to move, you just rebind to that same library on this other machine. Okay. Same is true of a printer. If you just want to access a printer and then you migrate the application and it wants to print, if there is a local printer, you can continue to provide access by just rebinding that type of resource to a locally available one. Okay. So these are the possibilities. What this table is showing is whenever you have resources that are accessed by identifier value or type, what happens? Okay. And then the column show that if that resource is unattached, meaning that it's inexpensive to move, is it fastened, which means it can move but at high cost, or is it fixed, which means it cannot move? Okay, what do you do for each of these categories? Okay, so the easiest way to understand this is to look at the table column by column. So if you look at this column or that one, you understand, and then you look at it by row. So by type should be easy, right? Since we already said if your resource is identified by type, you just want any resource that that sort of belongs to that type, then rebinding is the best option. So this is the printer example. Okay? So you just want to access a printer. It doesn't matter which one. You don't care particularly. You just want to print something. Okay? So in this case, regardless of whether the resource is attached, fastened, or fixed, you can just rebind to a locally available resource. Okay? So that is what this shows, that your first choice in this row is rebind, regardless, and then there are other choices, but you would always want to rebind first so that you have the least cost of migration. Okay? So let's not worry about type anymore, okay? Because type is, we already know what to do, regardless of how expensive is it to migrate the resource. Okay? Now, if it is unattached, you look at this column. Right? If the resource is unattached, regardless of whether it's identifier value or type, you can certainly move the resource because it is cheap. Okay, so you try to either move or copy, as is shown here. Okay. In the third category, you first try to rebind, because if you can avoid the migration cost altogether, you just rebind. If you cannot do that, then you can try to copy, as an example. Okay, that's what this column is showing. Okay, and if it is fixed, which is this column, which means resource cannot move, there is no other type, there's only one resource that the process wants to access and only that one. And the only thing you can do is provide remote access, which is what a global reference is. Okay, so you basically just allow the resource to be accessed over a network in this case, and that's what that column is showing. Okay, again, if it's by type, you try to rebind, but if it doesn't work, then you can always do remote access. Okay, now this at a very high level or at a very abstract level tells you how to handle resources that a process is trying to access. Okay, now coming back to excuse me, just one example. Let's take this issue of endpoints, which are open sockets, and see what one could do. Okay, so okay, so there are two processes, A and B. Okay, they are communicating over a network socket, TCP connection. Okay, B is now on one machine, it let's say is migrates to another machine. Okay, so I should make this a little more clear. This is A. Okay, B is here, it's a process. This is the OS. Okay, the TCP connection, the socket is actually the connect, socket state is maintained in the kernel because the TCP is implementation is in the kernel, and all that the application is doing is reading or writing to this socket. Okay, if you actually move this process, the kernel, the state of this process which is in the kernel space is not going to move. In other words, this is the socket state that the OS is maintaining for it. It doesn't move for multiple reasons. One is you haven't tried to move it. But even if you did, you couldn't because this socket is tied to a particular IP address. Okay, this process specified an IP address and a port number. Okay, so if you move this process somewhere, the IP address of the machine is running on has changed, so this socket is no longer going to work. Okay, so what could one do in this scenario? It doesn't work. So let's say that B has actually moved here on some other machine. Okay, A wants to still communicate with B, but when it, since it already has a socket connection, it doesn't even know that B has moved. Okay, so what could it do? How is it going to communicate, or how do we make this work?
If you send a request to A to ban this connection.
Okay, so you could send a request to A saying, I have moved, why don't you re-establish the connection? Yes, certainly possible. This requires application level support. In other words, when you write this application, you have to keep in mind that someday some other party that I'm talking to may move and I may get this request, so I may have to re-establish. Okay? So if that support is not built into the application, this is not just going to fail. I mean, A is going to write to the socket, you're going to get an error and that this connection is gone. Okay? It's just going to get torn down. You have something? Right. So you could forward this traffic and this can be done transparently. Okay, so in other words, what would happen is this is basically the home machine for A. That's the new machine, that's the new host. So if you want to make everything transparent, then when you move B, you have to take all the sockets, establish new ones from here to here. Okay, now this is basically acting as a relay or a router. Right? Every packet that's coming onto this socket just gets forwarded here and vice versa. Anything that's coming back from B, B continues to write to its local socket, so this gets forwarded here. Okay? So you have to keep this state in the network and start forwarding packets back and forth from the home machine to any other new machine. Okay, this is the only way you can make this work. Otherwise, the connections are just going to get broken and the application will not work anymore. Will the overhead be high? Of course, it's going to be high. If you want to make process migration transparent to the application, this is the only choice. Okay, so there is not much you can do. There is a version of IP for mobile devices where something like this is done. where you have a home location and that's your well-known IP address, any attempt to communicate there is forwarded. But there has to be state in the network to know that the machine, the process has moved to forward packet, where is the new location. We could move yet again, and then you have to rebind it and so on. So it is not very easy. Okay, so but that's the way to do it. Questions here? I'll talk about a slightly better way to do it in just a moment. Yeah, so, but this is, if you want to do this the way we have talked about, that's the, this is what you have to end up with. Okay? Now let's look at a slightly more challenging problem. This is migration in heterogeneous systems. Okay? So here we have implicitly assumed that the systems that you are using are homogeneous, meaning that the architecture, the hardware architecture as well as the OS is the same. Okay? So you are moving from Linux on x86 to Linux on x86. What if you didn't want to do that, meaning that you wanted to relax this restriction? You could move from a machine running Linux to Windows as one example. Even a more challenging example is that the hardware architecture has also changed. You move from a machine running Intel architecture to a machine that is Spark architecture or RISC architecture. Okay, is this possible to do? What does it imply with the migration system? Okay, that's what you're going to talk about here. Okay, now note that if you are doing weak mobility, this is not a problem. Okay, in weak mobility, you get the code, okay, and then you start start up a process. Okay, so if you wanted to support multiple architectures, then you just send a code in a way that it sort of is platform independent. This is what Java does anyway. It doesn't matter when you write this applet that's sitting on the server, you don't write it for x86 or Spark, you just write it to the JVM spec, which is an abstract machine. And then you could be running your browser on a x86 or Spark, it doesn't matter. Code comes to you and you just run it. Okay, so it's an intermediate form, it's not machine code that is coming to you. So you either send source code or some intermediate version of the code that can be dynamically compiled to machine code and executed. So weak mobility, this is not a problem. Heterogeneity is easily handled, and there are systems like Java that already do this, so it doesn't matter. Okay? Strong mobility is where the problem arises. So here you have a process that's already executing. Let's say it's a Linux process. Okay? Now you want to move it to so let's just take an example of Solaris machine. Okay? Solaris on Spark. Okay, hardware architecture is different, OS is also different. Okay? So what does this even mean? Can this be done? Okay? Now, conceptually it can be done, although there are very few systems that will actually do all of this. So conceptually what you have to do, what has changed, right? So you have to think about what do you do when you migrate the process. You migrate the code and you migrate its memory state, which is data. Okay? The data part is somewhat easily handled. If you know the types, you just have to handle the little Indian, big Indian type differences and you can move the data. Code is certainly not going to move as is. You cannot take machine code for one architecture and just run it on another architecture as is, okay, without doing something. Okay. So the choices are, you can recompile the code. If you actually had the code, the same code in intermediate form as well as the machine code, you actually migrate the intermediate form and recompile it using a just-in-time compiler. So you dynamically regenerate the code segment for the new architecture. Take the data and you do it. Okay, this is one way to do it. Yes, so this will come to all of that. I'm just talking conceptually what one could do. There are many other problems. Okay, the other way to do it is to do dynamic translation. You could migrate the code as is, but then the code has to be dynamically translated on the fly. Okay, so that it runs on the new machine architecture. Okay, there are technologies that do this, right? So if you actually look inside a Mac, okay, it comes with this technology called Rosetta. This allows you to run PowerPC binaries, okay, on Intel architectures without even changing the binary. It's not process migration, but it's just doing dynamic code translation. So when you start up a PowerPC binary, it is going to translate every instruction on the fly and execute it on x86. So it's going to just map every PowerPC instruction to equivalent one or more x86 instructions that do the same thing. Okay? So at least at the code level, this one, that's not process migration. It just allows you to start an app that was built for a different architecture and run it unmodified. So if you use a combination of technologies, it could possibly work. Okay? There's the notion of system level APIs, right? So you program to a system call interface. On Solaris, that system call interface may not be the same. Okay, then the process is not going to work. There are all sorts of problems, but conceptually, what you need to do is somehow you need to be able to run the code on a different architecture, either by recompiling it from intermediate form or doing dynamic translation, and then also transfer all of the data and handle the hardware difference. If you do all this, then it will probably work. Okay. Easier is to just use a language that is built to do this, right? So if you actually use Java, then this is probably much easier to do because the program is running against the JVM, not against the hardware architecture. It's running against an abstract notion of what the machine looks like. So so long as there's a JVM supported there, the abstract the interface that you provide to the application is the same, so long as it's the same JVM. So you could just move the state and run on a different JVM there and it would work. Okay. So this is how one could do migration in heterogeneous systems. Any questions here? Okay, this picture is just showing a whole set of steps one has to do all this, but let's not worry about that. Is this clear, what we just said? Okay. So now we are going to do two or three quick case studies before I move on to the next chapter, just to understand what process and code migration. Okay. So first one is something that you probably know about but haven't really thought of it as process or code migration. And this is either if you think of it as a application written for good purpose and think of it as agents, if you think of application written for malicious purposes, this could be worms. Okay? In either case, this is self-propagating code. Okay? This is code that basically runs on a machine. Okay? It can make some autonomous decision. In this case, the autonomous decision is it wants to propagate itself. It basically makes a copy of itself on some other machine and does something and then keeps doing it. That's how worms spread. I mean, they use an exploit and then they spread themselves. Okay, so then lots of machines get infected. Same is true of agents, but agents may be doing this for good reason. Like, so you may have written an agent to go and index data on that machine, so then you can do searches, distributed searches like Google search engines do. Okay? So you have this agent that basically hops around and then whatever new data it finds, it builds an index and then it hops to another machine. Okay? So in either case, this is a process that is autonomous, meaning that it's capable of reacting to and initiating changes to its environment. It's not that somebody just runs it. It makes its own decisions on what machine to move next and so on, okay, without someone telling it. Okay? So it's more than just a dumb process. It can act on its own. Okay? It has the capability to move through machine. It may need support for strong mobility, although one could just do it with weak mobility also. Okay? Many worms don't necessarily migrate the process. They just find the exploit and migrate the code and then just start up a process there. But there are agents that could just also support strong mobility. Okay? And there are examples like tickle agents and D agents that do support heterogeneous systems, but they use interpreted languages to get around this problem of strong mobility. They're interpreted, so migrating the code is much easier. So you just migrate it in intermediate form and just compile it down to machine code on the fly. Okay. This is just one example of where this mobility notion comes in, okay, although this may not be something you may have thought. Okay. Another example of process migration is Condor. So this is a system that is used in a cluster of machines to run batch jobs. Okay. Very similar to the Sprite concept, and this is a system that is still in use today. We have some in our department. So what happens here is, so you want to, let's say, run a batch job. This could be some simulation for your research. Okay? So you don't care where it runs. You just want the job to get done. So you just submit it to this system. And in this case, the system is a Condor system. And the system is going to find a machine for you to run it. Okay? And if there are problems with the machine, it will dynamically migrate this process to some other machine and continue to execute it until it finishes. And then you get the results back. So Condor, what it does is it can keep track of which machines are idle, which machines are in use. So it can harvest idle cycles, just as Sprite did. Whenever your machine was idle, it could send jobs. The same thing is done in Condor. It harvests idle cycles. In idle cycles, then can contact a Condor server for work. And if there's a queue of jobs that people have submitted that are waiting to run, one of these jobs is then sent off to machine. Okay. But what is interesting is it also has the ability to suspend the job, okay, and then migrate it and rerun it elsewhere. Okay. It needs a distributed file system to do this. It doesn't copy large amounts of data. So long as you have a distributed file system where a file is accessible from any machine, what it just does is it basically checkpoints the state, suspends the process, it checkpoints the state to disk, and then the assumption is the same file, the checkpointed file, is available on any other machine, so it can be resumed elsewhere. Okay? It has the ability to do this. Okay? So this is basically using a form of process migration. Is this clear? If you want to do process, so Condor actually works across heterogeneous machines, but it does not support process migration across heterogeneous machines. It doesn't do any of the things we talked about. It can, if you want to use this feature, then you have to assume that the machine you are migrating to is homogeneous. If it's heterogeneous, it will just kill the job and restart it. Okay, but then all of the computation is lost that it will do. Okay. Now the third technique I want to talk about is virtual machine migration. So we have talked about virtual machines quite a bit, and we talked about migration quite a bit. And actually, if you use these two things together, migration becomes very easy. Okay? So think of this as equivalent of process migration in the modern world. You can actually migrate entire virtual machines. Okay, so what is done here is very similar to process migration, but everything moves, not just one process. Okay, so let's just take, let's assume that this is a physical server and there's a hypervisor here. This is a virtual machine. Okay, the virtual machine runs an OS, many applications running, many processes running in the virtual machine. Okay. Now, rather than migrating one of these processes, which is what process migration does, virtual machines allow you to take this entire virtual machine and just migrate the whole thing to some other server. Okay? All modern virtual machine platforms support this feature. Okay? This is called VM migration. Okay, so what is done is the same thing that we talked about in process migration. You just take all of the pages here. So this is a virtual machine, right? So it has some RAM. You just take all the pages and just move them somewhere else. Okay, so this entire memory snapshot just appears here. Okay, and then you just resume execution there. Okay. So here, the important thing is the OS is also moving with the processes. Okay, so in other words, any state maintained by the OS also moves. In particular, socket connections, everything is going to move here. Okay. And so long as you can give this virtual machine the same IP address as the old one, because the old one is gone, nothing changes from the application perspective. The IP address has also moved with you. Okay, because the IP address is now not tied to this physical machine, it's tied to this virtual machine. This thing moved here, so you move the IP address also. Okay, this only works on a LAN, clearly. You cannot just take a virtual machine and move it to some other subdomain and assume your IP address is going to be the same. Routing won't work. But if you are on a LAN, you can certainly move it and the IP address can stay the same. Okay? So that's one thing. So this makes migration much easier, and you can actually migrate all of the processes, OS, everything. Okay? And this can be done transparently to the application. The application doesn't even know it has moved elsewhere, because it thinks it's running on the same OS. It thinks it's running on the same machine with the same IP address. Okay? So this is transparent, which means that it works with any arbitrary application. Okay? The application doesn't need to support any additional feature. Okay? Whatever you have today, that if it runs in a VM, it can be migrated. Okay. More interestingly, what this technology allows you to do is something called live migration, which is moving the VM while the application is running, okay, meaning you don't even have to suspend the application. Application can continue to run, and at the some point in time, there is just a switchover. It just basically hops from one machine to another. Okay. Now, the way this is done is that you have to migrate pages multiple times. Okay. If you don't want to suspend the VM, you just start migrating pages. Let's say you take page 1, you copy it over, page 2, you copy it over, so on, and you migrate n pages. Since the applications are executing in this period, they may change some pages. They may write to some pages, new processes may start up. So some subset of these pages, whatever you have transferred there, are no longer current. They are stale because those pages are changed. So you make another pass saying, has this page changed? If so, you transfer it. If not, you just say, no, it's there. And then you basically only transfer in the second pass pages that have changed. And you do this iteratively until the set of pages that need to be moved becomes small. Let's say it's less than 10. Okay. At this point in time, you will suspend this VM. Okay. Migrate those last few pages and then just terminate this VM and just start there. Okay. As I said, because the IP address has also changed, not as far as the applications are concerned, nothing changes. Okay. So the downtime is nearly zero. It's in the order of few tens of milliseconds. And the application continues to function. Yes.
Even though the downtime is zero, it sounds like this would take up a lot more network traffic.
Yes, it will take. The question is network traffic. Yes, there are multiple passes here, right? If you had suspended it, you could have just moved in one pass everything. But an application is not functioning in this period. Okay, but in this case, you are basically, it's a trade-off. You continue to run your application and you are doing this transparently, so there are multiple passes. So if in the worst case, you may have many passes because as you're sort of moving down this list, migrating pages, you just start dirtying this page. So then you come back and then you do the same thing. So this can take many cycles to do. Okay? So network traffic is going to be higher because pages may be copied repeatedly because they're changing in every pass. Okay, but the upside is applications don't go down. Okay? This is very useful if you're running critical application that you don't want to take down. Somebody's website. Okay, so if it's a critical website, you don't want it to be down, but you want it to move to another machine, a bigger machine perhaps. Yeah, so things like this are done from a migration standpoint. So as I said, VMware, Xen, they all support this. Okay, so and it is actually used for a variety of purposes. How will this work in type 2 hypervisors? So typically, I mean, the concept is the same. The question is this type 1 or type 2? So in type 2, this is your host. This is type 2. Okay. So conceptually, although type 2 hypervisors actually don't support this feature because they're not meant for this purpose. But there is no difference. You just start copying pages. Okay. And then you do this iteratively. At some point, you just have to freeze this and copy the last few pages and resume that. The assumption is that the IP address can stay the same. If the IP address cannot stay the same, none of this works. Okay? So whatever IP address was bound to this machine has to stay the same, which also means it cannot be a NATed address. Because if it's a NAT address, then to the external world, you only see the host IP address. So if it's a NATed VM, it's not going to work. Okay, but if it has a public IP address, then the same thing will work. Is that clear? You have a question? File system migration, yes. So, I didn't talk about files here. This was just memory state. So, when you create a VM, you can also create disks, local disks that go with it, right? So, if you actually want to do live migration and the disk is local, then you have to pay the overhead of copying the disk, which can be high because disk state could be gigabytes of data. Okay? Typically, where this actually works is where the data is stored on a network file server somewhere else. Okay? So you have NFS mounts here. So all the applications are accessing data on an NFS share somewhere. Okay? So you can move the state and this NFS share is also available here. So you continue to access it as if nothing has happened. Okay? So you either have a storage area network or a network file system. Then this works. Otherwise, there is a problem. You have to copy data, okay, and which is expensive. It can be done. It's just expensive to do. Okay. Any other questions here? Okay, so this is where we will switch to another. Let's just. Okay. So that's end of chapter 3. So now we are going to switch gears and move to chapter 4. Which is communication in distributed system. Okay, so this is the first major topic beyond the processes that we and threads that we talked about. Okay. So here what we are going to talk about are message-oriented communication, what are remote procedure calls, remote method invocation, stream communication. Now, the goal here is not to say understand what RPCs are, that you may probably know, but rather the goal is to understand how to build an RPC system. Yeah, how do you build, what does the RPC or RMI runtime have to do in order to enable RPCs or RMIs? Because that is, we are interested in building distributed system, not just understanding how to build application. Okay? So we'll actually go into the guts of these systems to understand how they work and what they do. Okay? But as far as today's lecture is concerned, we are only going to look at this broad issue of communication at a more abstract level. Just try to understand higher level issues. And then we look at actual systems starting next class or next lecture. So we'll look at now various issues one at a time. The first one is communication between processes. How does that happen and what are the various ways to do this? So if you have two processes, so assumption is you have an application which is distributed. Okay? And so basically the application is at least two processes, okay? Not threads, but two independent processes. And these processes want to communicate. Okay, so how do you do this? Here is one process, here is another process. Okay. Now, if these two processes were actually on the same machine, okay, you could use multiple ways to communicate. You could either use messages that are sent back and forth, okay, or you could use shared memory. Okay, so in shared memory, so it's the same thing. What happens is, let's assume both of these are on the same machine. So in shared memory, there's a region of memory that's accessible to both processes. So you are sending messages by writing into a shared data, shared memory region. Okay, so basically, if you want to send a message here, you just write whatever you are going to send in that message in the shared memory region. And then this is basically, then this process has to go and read that. And then you're just communicated. And the same thing can happen in the reverse direction. This is one way to send messages, okay, using shared memory. Now, this is much harder, obviously, if the process that you are trying to communicate with is on a different system altogether. Okay, there is no memory that you share if the two processes are on different system. Okay, now there is something called distributed shared memory, which we will not talk about here. In distributed shared memory or DSM, process gets access to memory on a remote machine. Okay, so you can actually access that. So we will not talk about that here, but we will come back to this when we do RMIs a little bit. Okay. So if you use shared memory to communicate, this is referred to as unstructured communication. There's no real messages. You're just using reading and writing to shared memory as a way to communicate. But if you use explicit messages or inter-process communication, IPCs, then we call that structured communication. Okay? And this is by far more common because in most distributed systems, the applications span multiple machines. Now, very quickly, you probably all know what a protocol stack looks like, so I just put up a picture here. So protocols are rules that all parties that are involved in communication agree to. Okay? So long as each party follows the rules, you can sort of communication can happen. So the protocols could be connection-oriented like TCP or connection-less like UDP. Okay? And in a protocol stack, you have multiple layers. This is our layered stack that we had looked at in the very first class. And each layer is basically communicating to the peer layer at the other end, okay, using the protocol it has agreed to. So here you have physical protocol, you have data link, network, transport, session, presentation, and application. In a TCP stack, transport layer is either TCP or UDP, the network layer is IP, data link layer depends on what you are using. If it's Ethernet, then you use the MAC protocol there. You don't typically have session and presentation layers. Everything, all of this functionality is basically the responsibility of the application. Okay? This all of you, I presume, know already. Okay, but keep this in mind because this is going to be important, you know, a slide or two when we talk about client-server communication. Okay? This is what a message looks like. Okay, so message basically the applications are at this endpoint. So whenever this application sends a message, it goes down the protocol stack. Each layer basically processes that message, adds its own headers and sends it down. Okay, then it goes on the wire and it appears at this end and then it propagates up. Okay, and each layer then basically looks at the headers that the peer layer had sent, knows what to do and sends it up. Okay? So as a result, when you actually see the message on the wire, you see a number of headers. Okay? So this is the payload itself. This is the application level header, the header that the session layer would have added, which doesn't is not present in TCP. This is the TCP headers, IP headers, MAC headers. Okay? Rather the MAC headers, this is the IP header, TCP header, session and presentation not present, application level headers and the message. Okay? So the protocol is HTTP, just to give you a very concrete example. This is what the HTTP request itself is. It could be a GET request saying get me this page. This is the HTTP header. Okay, this is the application level header. Then you add a TCP and an IP header on top of it and a MAC header and send it out. Okay? Clear? So now let's look at client-server communication and TCP. So this is what this is the message exchange that TCP is involved in for to set up a connection. Okay, so let's assume that there's a client and there is a server. You want to communicate. Okay, to do this, you have to first establish a socket connection. Okay, assume that you are using TCP to communicate. Okay, so for example, this could be a web browser that's a web server. And you're using HTTP at the application level, which runs on TCP. Okay? So this is the message exchange. So the client has to send what's called the TCP at the client end sends what's called a SYN packet. Okay? This tells the server that the other party wants to establish a TCP connection. Okay? And then you send an acknowledgement to the SYN saying, I received your SYN, I'm willing to start the connection. And you also send a SYN in the other way. Because TCP is bidirectional communication, you need to set up connections in either directions. So then the client will then send back an ACK to the SYN that the server sent. So at this point, you have a two-way channel established, okay, over TCP, and either parties can start sending packet. Okay. Now let's suppose it's a HTTP message exchange. So you send a request, which is going to be an HTTP request. Okay. And then you just send a FIN because you are done. Okay, the only thing in a HTTP scenario is you send a request, you get back a response. Next time you send another request. So the assumption is every time you do this, you will set up a new TCP connection. So in typical request response paradigm, you set up the channel and you just send one message, one request, and then you are done sending. Okay? So here you send a request and then you send a FIN saying I am done. Okay? Now you get back an ACK saying I received your request and the FIN. Then the server is going to do some processing. In this case, it's processing the HTTP request. It may generate a HTML page or it may generate a GIF image, whatever was requested. Okay? And that is going to come back as a response. Okay? Then the response is sent, you are done. You also send a FIN and tear down the connection. Okay? And then you get an ACK back. At this point, the connection is torn down in both directions. Okay? Note that you basically, as soon as you are done communication, you can tear down your side of the connection. But the other way is still going to be active until a FIN comes on the other side, from the other side. Okay? Now, what is important to know is that just to send this one request, okay, one message, and get back one reply, assume that the entire response fits in one packet. To do this two-packet exchange, you have to exchange 9 packets if you use TCP to communicate. Okay? That's the only point I wanted to make here, not to sort of explain TCP. But just to point out that in this request response or client server communication where you set up a new TCP connection, to send these two messages, you have a total overhead is 9, okay, which is high. So, but that's the price you have to pay if TCP is the way you go. Now, there was one optimization to TCP which allows you to piggyback multiple of these messages into a single message, okay, and reduce the communication overhead. Okay, so this is called transactional TCP. So just a research proposal, never got implemented. So in this case, the number of messages, this is the same semantics, nothing has changed. The only thing is you are doing multiple things in one message. So here, you have only 3 messages. So the first, the client sends a SYN saying I want to open a connection, TCP connection. Here is the request I want to send and I am done. And all 3 things can just go in one payload. Okay? It goes to the server. Yeah, the server knows that this guy wants to open up a new connection and he's already sent the request. Okay? So you basically send a SYN in the other direction saying, okay, I want to open a connection in the other direction. Send an ACK to the FIN saying, I received everything until your FIN. Okay? You also send a response. Say, here is the response, your request, and a FIN saying, I'm done. Okay? So in this one message, you got all these 4 things. and then all that the client has to do is just act the fin saying, I received everything you sent me, and then the connection is broken. Okay. So if you could do this, then your overhead of request response goes down to 3 messages. So you send a request, get a response, it's only one extra message that has gone by on the wire. Okay. So you went from 9 to 3, and this is referred to as transactional TC. Unfortunately, there's no implementation that is actually using, or any TCP implementation that uses this, because there you have to make some changes to the protocol itself to do this optimization. Okay, but this was a proposal that had come up and, to optimize the overhead of TCP. Is this clear? Okay. So, the next thing to keep in mind as we sort of talk about various things is in TCP, I said there is no presentation or session layer. So everything is the responsibility of the application. Okay, beyond the transport protocol, anything you want to do, if you want to do encryption, for example, okay, all of that has to be done at the application level. You have to use secure sockets and HTTPS. So applications become more complex because they have to implement a lot of the functionality that that may be common across multiple apps. So as a result, what some people have done is they have built what is called a middleware. This is just a layer that sits between the transport protocol and the application that can provide many useful services. Okay. So in this case, what the application does, okay, is that it basically just communicates with the middleware layer on its machine. The middleware is then responsible for communicating to the middleware layer on the peer machine, and then that is just going to talk to the application endpoint at the other end. Okay. So if you do this, then a lot of the functionality that is normally the responsibility of the application can be now put into the middleware layer. And we will talk about several middleware layers that people have built as we go through various topics. But just keep this in mind that middleware protocols, basically they sit between the OS and the application, because everything below the transport layer is in the kernel and the application is in user space. So it's going to sit between these two, and they implement many general purpose protocols. And they're very useful as a result. Okay? We'll come back to distributed commit when we do chapter 5 or 6. And at that point, we'll see how the middleware layer helps you do useful things. Okay? So now coming back to the client-server model, okay, so we'll talk about 3 ways to achieve this. Okay, one is through just vanilla sockets, raw sockets to implement a client-server communication. The second one is remote procedure calls. The third one is remote method invocation. All of these 3 techniques allow you to allow a client to send a message to the server, and the server to send back a response. Okay, but there are 3 different ways of implementing a request-response paradigm. Okay? So I'm assuming that most of you do know something about sockets at least, okay, if not RPCs and RMIs, but we will talk about some of this quickly. Okay. Now here is just a picture that shows a client, here's a client file server that talks to a client that talks to a file server, and it sends a message. Okay, so this message has to go over the wire and come to this end. And the assumption is you can implement the client and the file server through using any of these 3 methods. Okay. Now this is something to keep in mind, because the first programming assignment that I'm going to hand out next week, okay, requires you to implement a distributed application which will probably use a client-server paradigm. So your design decision is going to be, are you going to program using sockets, remote procedure calls, or RMIs? Okay. This to an extent also depends on what language you are going to use, because that language may not support all 3, it may only support some subset of these. Okay? So it's important to understand what these are, or what are the implications of using this. Okay? So we'll come back to some of these issues, but just keep that in mind. Okay? Now I'm going to quickly talk about addressing in client-server communication. We already looked at this a little bit last time. Blocking versus non-blocking communication, buffered versus unbuffered, reliable, unreliable, server architecture, and scalability. So addressing part, I mentioned last time, so I'm going to go through this quickly. This is the question of how is the server located. Okay, you have written a client, there's a server running somewhere, how do you contact it? Okay, so the first choice is you will hardwire the address in the client. So you run the server on a particular machine, you know where it is running, you hard code that into the client, so client just contacts that IP address and you are done. Okay? Now if the server moves to another machine, this your client will break, it's not going to be able to communicate anymore. So we looked at this other alternatives where you have to dynamically figure out where is the server running. Okay? There are many techniques that we talked about. Okay? So one that we did not talk about is broadcast based. And here you just broadcast, so if this is on a LAN at least, you just broadcast a request saying, if you are running this service, send me back a response. Okay? So you send this broadcast message and then the server, this message actually goes to all machines on the network, or in this case the LAN, and wherever the server is running, that machine sends back a response. So you have discovered using a broadcast based mechanism. Okay? This is one approach to do this. Okay? Another approach is to use a name server or a directory service. This is what we talked about last time, saying when the server comes up, it registers with a directory service. That you assume that the directory service is running on a well-known machine and on a well-known port. So you first contact the directory service saying, where is this server running? The directory service tells you this is the machine, then you go contact that machine. Okay, so we talked about this already. Any questions yet? Fairly straightforward. So the next technique that we will talk about, or not next technique, the next dimension is the communication between the client and the server synchronous or asynchronous, or in other words, blocking or non-blocking. Okay? In blocking communication, you assume that the client sends a request and it is going to wait until a response comes back. It's not going to do anything. It's blocked for a response. Okay? In non-blocking communication, you use asynchronous messages. So what happens is, as soon as you do a send, the send is going to return immediately, and the client can continue to do what it wants. At some later point, the response comes back and an interrupt or a signal is sent to the client saying a message has arrived. Okay? So in the first case, in order to communicate via messages, you'll do a send. Okay, and this will be a message. So as soon as you do this is a system call. Okay, so you are going to make a system call and you are going to block. The send is not going to return until a response arrives. Okay, and then the arguments are going to be a response. So this is not really how it is done. What actually happens is, when you do a send, the message actually gets copied to the kernel space. Okay, and then it's sent out. But to get back a response, you will immediately do a receive here. And then that is what is going to block for you. Okay? But in either case, it is blocking communication. It's not non-blocking. You are going to wait until a response comes back. Okay? In this case, you don't. Now, what is the advantage of either approach? So if you want to use synchronous, is easier to understand because that's easier to program. In asynchronous communication, you have to basically set up message handlers and interrupt handlers and whatnot, because message responses can come at any time and you have to stop doing what you're doing and then take delivery of the message. Okay? So this is harder to program. Okay? And this is somewhat easier. Okay? Now if you use multi-threaded programming, this will allow you to basically get all of the benefits of doing this. Okay, without using having to sort of do all this message handlers and so on. Okay. So that's one advantage. If you have only one thread of control and you do synchronous communication, then you can only have one message exchange at any given time, because you send the first message and you're blocked. You can't do anything else. Okay, if there are multiple messages to send, you have to block until the response to the first one comes back. Okay. Now this you can do with multiple threads, as we had talked about earlier. You can have multiple threads. Each one does blocking communication, but you still get concurrency in your app. Okay? All of these again have implications on your system design. Okay? Because the assignment again will require you to do concurrent communication. So if you have only one thread, you are going to have performance issues. Okay? Because it can only send one request, get one response at a time. So you have to decide whether you want to do multi-threaded or whether you want to do asynchronous. Okay? This is the only way to scale up. Okay. Now the next issue, which is also somewhat related to synchronous and asynchronous, is whether communication is buffered or unbuffered. Okay. In unbuffered communication, both the client and the server, or both endpoints, are assumed to be running at the same time. Okay. And in this case, whenever a message arrives, it is immediately delivered to the other application. Okay. So there is no buffering going on. So you basically just send the message and it arrives at the other. In buffered communication, there is a buffer or a mailbox that is maintained somewhere by the system, and the message actually arrives and sits in the mailbox. It is not delivered automatically to the other endpoint. And the endpoint has to, or in this case the server, has to contact the mailbox or the buffer in order to take delivery of the message. Okay? So this also means that when a message arrives, the server does not have to be running, because the message is delivered to mailbox, not to the server. It's just that the mailbox belongs to the server, so it can take delivery at a later time. Okay? Now just to give you an example, if you take email, that's an example of buffered communication, and if you take instant messaging, that's more of an example of unbuffered communication. If you use IMs or chat, you assume that both parties are actually there and you're sending messages back and forth, and both parties have to be actively participating in communication. On the other hand, in email, I can send an email to any other person. That person doesn't have to be logged in or accessing his mail client when the mail message arrives. It just gets delivered to, in this case, his or her mailbox. And at a later point, the mail client will then take delivery of this message from the mailbox. Okay, so the same analogy is true in this case. Okay, so communication paradigm could be either buffered or unbuffered. Is this clear? So reliability is another problem, and we are not going to talk a whole lot about reliability of communication here in this course rather, but I just want to mention that this is something important. So if you basically use a protocol like UDP for your communication, UDP does not guarantee you any reliabilities. In this case, you may send a message, the message message is only going to be delivered in a best effort manner, and there are no guarantees that the protocol is giving. The message can be dropped somewhere on the network, in which case it's never delivered. Okay? So if you use something like UDP, the responsibility of reliability now is at the application level. The application has to keep track of what messages were sent, have they been received, if not you have to retransmit. On the other hand, if you use, and this is typically done using acknowledgements, needless to say, so to understand whether a message has reached the other end, you have to wait for an acknowledgement. When the acknowledgement comes, you know that it was received. Okay? Now, these problems can be just gotten around by just simply using something like TCP, right, which already guarantees you a reliable channel. So in this case, the transport protocol is taking care of retransmissions for you and acknowledgements. So all you do is you just send a message and you get a reply at the application level. You don't worry about whether is the message, has it reached the other end, should I retransmit, was there an acknowledgement. All of that is still happening. Meaning internally it is still the same picture here, but the acts and so on and retransmissions are transparent to the application. They are handled by the transport layer. Okay? So that's basically the pros and cons of using a reliable communication protocol versus unreliable. Okay? So you may think, why are we even bothered? Let's always use reliable. Why should we even bother about unreliable communication? Now, the reason for this is there are many scenarios where you don't have time to wait for an acknowledgement or retransmission. Okay? Video streaming is a good example. A lot of video streaming data, not all. Okay? A lot of video streaming data goes over UDP, not over TCP. And the reason for this is there is some timeliness constraints that are associated with video streaming. If the data doesn't arrive at your machine by the time it's supposed to be played out on the screen, you're just going to see that the screen freeze. Okay? Or so there'll be a drop and your playback is just going to move several frames ahead and you'll just see a gap. Okay? Retransmitting this data at a later point when the playback point has gone by is of no use. Okay, you already played past that point, and when the data arrives later, it's completely useless. Okay, so acknowledgements and retransmissions don't help. Okay, they may only help if you keep a large buffer and you are playing at the head of the buffer and data is arriving at the tail, and so long as you haven't gone past this point, you can still retransmit. But typically these buffers are small, so you don't end up doing this. Okay, so there are scenarios where unreliable communication makes sense, and those transport protocols are like UDP are used. Okay, but in most cases, you just use TCP and avoid this problem at the application level. Okay. So now, let's look at how would you go about designing your server itself. Are you going to use a sequential architecture or a concurrent architecture? And we briefly alluded to this earlier as well. Okay. Now, in a sequential architecture, the server is going to service one request at a time. Okay, that's why it's called pure sequential architecture. Now, this is called pure sequential. If you use asynchronous communication, you could still have one thread of control. Okay. So, you go to what is called the event-based architecture that we had mentioned earlier. So, you can basically service one request and then do some asynchronous communication, jump to servicing another request and come back and so on. Okay. So, this is event-based. Okay. Now, the two other models which use synchronous communication are thread-based and process-based communication. Okay. So, in this case, you will still use standard blocking calls, but you get concurrency either by using multiple threads or multiple processes for your server. Okay. So, you have pure sequential where you service one request at a time. Okay. For the concurrent choice, there are the concurrent approach, there are three choices. Asynchronous communication, one thread of control. Synchronous communication or synchronous I/O, multiple threads. Synchronous communication, multiple processes. So you could design your server in any of these fashion. So let's assume that pure sequential is going to have problems, okay, because you can only service one request at a time. The all other requests have to be queued up, so there is going to be bad performance. So you do want some concurrency, but the question is, what are the pros and cons of these approaches? So which architecture would be the most efficient and why is a good thing to consider. So any thoughts on which of these three architectures is the most efficient? Yes.
What do you mean when you say efficient?
Yeah, so that was going to be my next question. So you have to now understand when I say most efficient, what does this mean? Right? Where does the efficiency come in? So if you think about it, so you are trying to achieve concurrent processing of requests. Okay? Where do the inefficiencies come in? Inefficiencies come in because you may be, when you change from servicing one request to another, there may be some overhead involved there. Okay, so you are servicing request I, and then you switch to servicing request J. Okay, the overhead involved in this switch is where inefficiencies are going to creep in. Because once you're servicing a request, regardless of which of the architectures you pick, they're going to have to do the same amount of work to service that request. Okay, only when, since you're doing concurrency, you're going to switch back and forth. And the switching cost is where the inefficiency is creeping. Okay. Now, with that in mind, what would be the overheads involved in event-based, thread-based, and process? So, let's start from the process-based. This is the easiest to understand. Okay. What is the overhead of concurrent processing when you have multiple processes in your server? Okay. It's context switching. Because the assumption is you have a pool of processes. Okay. And whenever a new request comes in, you give it to one process and it is going to start processing that request, and at some point it may block because it wants to access a file, and then you switch, the CPU just starts servicing some other process, and then so you have this context switch overhead when you switch between requests. This is the overhead that you incur when you have process based architecture. Okay. Thread base should be also clear. It's also context switch, but now you're context switching threads, not context switching processes. And we already talked about this, saying context switching between threads of the same process is far cheaper than context switching independent processes. Okay? So this is going to be more efficient than that. This should be clear. Okay? Now the last one is event based. Okay? It's going to be event handlers. So you're servicing something, you go or jump somewhere. So overhead of jumping, what is that?
Keeping track of
state, but in terms of execution overhead, what's the overhead? You have to keep track of it everywhere. So you're just transferring control from one function to another. So overhead is almost at the function call level, right? So you basically interrupt comes in, you invoke interrupt handler. So you sort of just jump to that function call and execute it. So making a function call is much cheaper than any context switcher, as you can imagine. Okay. So in other words, the event-based architecture will always give you the highest performance. Yeah, the thread based is the next, and the process based is the last. Okay, in terms of pure performance. Okay. Now, in terms of implementation complexity, event based is going to be much higher. Okay, because here you have to do asynchronous programming. For every event, there has to be an event handler. There's no sequential execution. You're executing something, event occurs, and then you jump somewhere. And you're executing there, some other event occurs. If it's higher priority, you'll jump somewhere else. Okay. So debugging and maintaining this code base is much harder. Okay. And you're doing asynchronous communication. So thread-based and process-based, much easier. Sequential execution through one thread using blocking calls. Okay, so in terms of writing your application, this is much simpler. But in terms of getting performance out of it, this is much harder to do it here because the overheads are much higher. Okay. So that's the trade-off. So you will see that the highest performing servers will use, if performance matter, you go down this route. If it doesn't matter, then you use one of these two. Okay. Apache started, the Apache web server that is, started with a process-based architecture. For the longest time, it had a process-based architecture, and this is because Linux was very good at switching processes. Okay, the overhead of doing this in Linux was fairly low, but when you ran Apache on other platforms, context switch overheads were bad, and performance of Apache, although it's widely used, was not that great. Newer variants of Apache have gone to a thread-based architecture as a result. Okay. Because going to event-based architecture would have meant complete re-implementation. That if you have a large code base, you can't just throw it all away and start afresh. So Apache is now more efficient. It uses threads. It's gone from a process base. But there are web servers that are event-based, and they are much better at servicing high-volume requests than Apache's. Yeah, just as an example. So again, this is something to keep in mind. When you write your client-server application for the project, you have to have some concurrency. This is probably not good enough, so you'll have to pick between these three. Okay? In most cases, I'm assuming you'll probably end up picking this, okay? Because this is harder, but some people sometimes do use event-based architectures. So I'll talk about one last issue, and then we will probably stop here. Okay. And that is scalability. Okay. So we have thus far, this is a recurring theme. We have already talked about scalability multiple times. Okay. So last class I was talking about multi-tier architectures as a way to, and replication within each tier as a way to scale, okay, if you remember. So this is just basically a set of things you could do if you want to scale the server capacity. So you have a server that's running on some machine. Maybe you want to increase its capacity. Okay. What do you do? You could, of course, buy a bigger machine, okay? But there are always limits to it. At some point, you cannot buy a machine that is big enough to house your application. Okay? If you're Amazon or Google, it's never going to fit in one application, in one machine. Okay? So at some point, you not buy a bigger machine, but what you will do is buy more machines. Okay? And that is where you go into the replication world. Okay? So you start with your entire server running on one machine. You can scale its capacity some by buying, let's say, multiple processors or multi-core machines, lots of RAM, but at some point you're going to hit that bottleneck of one machine. So then at that point you have no choice but to replicate your server. Okay, then you run on multiple machines. When you replicate, you have a whole bunch of issues you have to think about. Okay? Depending on what your server is doing, if your server is modifying state, now the state of your entire server is distributed. So when it's modified at server 1, there are implications on what has happened at server 2. Does it have old state? Is this state going to propagate and whatnot? Okay. So we'll come back to replication as an entire chapter in the book. So we'll come back to this issue later. Okay. And when you replicate, you also have to think about the algorithms and the data structures that you use. Okay. The trivial way of replicating is what is called partitioning. Okay. You have a large database. Okay, database server is overloaded, you run database server on two machines, you say machine 1 now is responsible for the first 10 tables and machine 2 is responsible for the next 10 tables. So you just partitioned your database. Your workload is still split, okay, and you basically have just partitioned the data in this case, and now two servers can service all of the incoming requests. Okay. There may be imbalances depending on which tables get accessed at which time and so on. Okay. This is straightforward partitioning. You could have real replication where all of the tables are on both machines. Okay? Now the problem is if table is modified on machine 1 and it is cached on machine 2, the cache is outdated. So you don't want problems like this. So you have to get around it. So the algorithms and data structure that you use whenever you have replication is always very important. And that's what we are going to talk about when we talk about this replication chapter. Okay. Of course, caching is another very easy way to scale capacity. Okay. So before you do some of this, the first thing people do when they hit a performance bottleneck is they put a cache. Okay. Cache could be a faster machine, or you basically put more RAM so you can hold disk state in memory. And you can scale up capacity if you get good cache hits. Okay, so this is a very common approach to getting to scaling your system. Before you do some of these more complicated things, just try putting a cache. Okay? And caching we'll talk about. Caching and replication actually are the same in one chapter, so we'll come back to that. Okay. The other thing you could do is basically ship code instead of data. What that says is, rather than having requests come to the data, you send some of the data back closer to the request. Okay, so the request. So here you have much larger distributed system where data is widely replicated and data is stored close to client, so you can just access data either locally or semi-locally instead of going to one large server or a pool of servers at some remote end. Okay? So when we talk about content distribution network, some of these issues will come back. We'll come back to and we'll look at how do you do this. Okay, so instead of scaling by just adding more machines, we can just distribute a lot of this functionality of processing and offload it to client. Okay, that's what this technique does. So we have run out of time. There are two or three more slides here to go. I'll talk about them next time. And the topic for next class is to look at remote procedure call system, and then we'll look at RMIs as well. Okay, so let's just stop here. If you came in late, there's a homework on the web page. It's due a week from today. Okay.